You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Just a quick mention here that it's you. You play a vital role in funding the programs you're passionate about. And whatever your reason for giving, is it in-depth news, interesting conversations, the music? This spring member drive is your time to support the service you rely on. Make your gift today. It is the final day of our drive. The number is 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. And thank you for your support. So right now we have veteran science correspondent Joe Palka for the hour fielding your curious science questions. Kids especially join us because there couldn't be a better time to think like a science journalist. Think like a Joe Palka. No one wants to spread bad information during this pandemic. But it can be hard, right? It can be hard to distinguish facts from rumors. What do you want to clear up about germs, face masks, pandemics, or our lungs? What questions do you have for Joe Palka? What are you wondering about his big ideas? We're at 800-642-1234 throughout the hour. Joe Palka has been a science correspondent for NPR since 1992. He's the host of the series Joe's Big Idea, founder of NPR SciCommerce. That's a science communication collective. Joe, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, it's great to be back.
Well, you've been doing this a long, long time, but, you know, pandemics are rare, once in a generation event or less. And since everything started late last year, what has surprised you in these past few months? What have you learned?
Oh, I guess I'm not surprised, but I spent my career saying, oh, you know, global pandemics could occur. And we used to talk about, people getting on an airplane in Nairobi or Wuhan or wherever and winding up in Washington and bringing a disease with them. And it was always a little bit hypothetical. I mean, the public health experts warned about this and we repeated their warnings and it all made sense. And now it's real. And oh, my goodness, you know, it's just everything that people warned about is actually happening. And it's pretty stunning. The other thing that I have to say surprises me, and I don't really get it, and this is a sort of a problem more generically with accurate facts, accuracy, is people saying, oh, they're just making this up. Oh, this isn't real. Oh, this isn't happening. Oh, you know, and I'm boggled by that because it's happening. I mean, my next door neighbor across the street is in the hospital right now. And I don't think he's faking it. I mean, he's ill with something and it's this virus. And the notion that, oh, you know, this is some scheme to change political power in the country is just mind boggling to me. And I guess that's the whole part of, you know, telling the truth, being accurate. It seemed like once upon a time that was good enough. You know, now it's like, well, how do I know? You know, how do I know you're telling the truth? Well, I don't know. I mean, nobody ever asked me that before. It is the case. I'm telling the truth.
Well, let's dig into some questions here, and let's start out with Jessica, who's joining us from Door County with a question. Jessica, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call this morning. My question is, with all of us using sanitizers and bleach and making our environment so clean, if there's going to be a backlash of like superbugs or something that's going to affect us after this virus is under control.
Because
and
we're not exposed. Yeah, Jessica, thank you. Because we're exposed to a lot less when we are bleaching our counters every minute, Joe.
Well, yeah, I suppose that's possible. But, you know, the other thing is I've read that that the number of cases of flu declined precipitously after the coronavirus appeared. And that's a good thing because that you don't want to get flu either. I mean, we're not so scared of flu because we're familiar with it. But, you know, 30 or 40,000 Americans die of flu each year. And so the idea that, yes, you can be more hygienic and less likely to transmit diseases, I really don't think there's going to be a backlash. I mean, there was this idea once that, you know, if we keep such a germ-free environment, we will be susceptible to germs we don't know about. But, you know, if you're careful about washing your hands and cleaning your food items and boxes that come from stores that you haven't handled only by yourself, the chances that somebody has left some trace of a disease on it goes way down. So I think in general, this move to cleanliness is going to be positive. I mean, you see doctors doing it all the time. They're always, or healthcare workers, they're always washing their hands. And there's a reason for that, because it's the easiest way to transmit a disease is from your hand to your mouth or to your eyes or to your nose. And there you go.
We're talking with Joe Palca. He's a science correspondent for NPR. We're looking at the science around the coronavirus and the big wide world of science that he covers, with your questions front and center, 800-642-1234. Joe, Jessica also asked about a superbug. Is there a good definition of what a superbug is and what it would do?
Well, I think it's one that has a cape and flies around. And Sorry, no. I think a superbug is simply a germ of some sort. By bug, I think we're talking about a germ or a bacteria or a virus, that not an insect-like creature. And a superbug is one that is uncontrollable by current methods. And I guess you probably could put COVID-19, the virus that causes that, into that category. I mean, I'll look in my science dictionaries, but I don't think that science bug is necessarily a scientific term, although I think people use it to mean something that's very threatening and very potent and potentially very dangerous. So superbug, yeah.
Yeah, we have some kids' questions flowing in here. And so let's get a little bit behind those here and viruses. Let's hear from Patrick.
Hello, my name is Patrick. I'm 6. If a virus isn't alive, how can it infect you or make you sick?
That's a great question.
It is a great question. And Patrick, you've hit on the meaning of life in a sense. Because what is life? There is a huge scientific debate about whether viruses are alive or not. They aren't typically speaking alive because they can't replicate themselves on their own. They need to rely on the cellular machinery of some host. Okay, what do I mean by that? I mean the virus has to infect a cell and then trick the cell into making copies of the virus. So really, in a sense, you can think of a virus as a set of instructions for making itself. Now, is that alive? Well, I don't know. I mean, there's plenty of things that can make us sick that aren't alive. You can drink poison, and poison isn't alive, and that'll make you sick. The difference is that in this case, it's kind of funny, but the virus actually doesn't make you sick. It infects you. You make yourself sick because it's your immune response to the virus that's causing some of the fever, that's a response to an infection, or chills, that's another, or congestion or coughing or things like that. Those are the things that actually make you feel sick. The virus, in most cases, is just doing what it does, which is making copies of itself in cells that it can infect.
We're exploring the world of science, the pandemic, how to cover the news developments with NPR science correspondent Joe Palca is at our side. So are you a researcher? What do you think about the news that's coming out about the pandemic? Scientists, how do you share your work around the world with the world? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a moment with Joe Palca right here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a quick note that it is listener support that is the largest source of funding for Wisconsin Public Radio. And that's pretty remarkable. This spring member drive, support the programs you value. Give on this final day of the drive at this number. It's 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. And thank you for your support. Right now, we're spending the hour with NPR science correspondent Joe Palca, getting his insights on the pandemic, because the virus is so new, there's still a lot we don't fully understand. And let's face it, science is messy. Studies can be confusing. They can be even contradictory. Science is a process, and we're trying to make sense of it with your questions along the way at 800-642-1234. So, Joe, we have another wonderful kid question. Let's hear from Miriam.
My name is Miriam. I have a few questions about the coronavirus. How does the coronavirus spread so quickly? And what does the coronavirus look like? And was there other people in the world that had the coronavirus before the first person that we discovered had the coronavirus? Done.
So did you get all that?
I think so. Let's see. Well, what does it look like? Well, if you had a microscope, a really good one, and you could see it, it would sort of look like, I was thinking, it kind of looks like an orange studded with cloves, because it's round and it's got these pokey things on the outside. And those are called, it doesn't matter what they're called. They happen to be called antigens, but you can think of them a little bit like cloves. And in a way, it's not a bad analogy, because the immune system in our bodies, the thing that keeps us safe from most of these diseases, it actually, in a sense, smells those cloves, or in this case, detects the antigens on the virus. And that's how it starts to fight off the virus. Now, how does it spread so quickly? Well, the reason it spreads so quickly is that it's infectious. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that it's easy, if you get even a small amount of it into your eyes or into your nose, or not so much into your mouth, but those, I think, all the eyes and nose. It tends to infect cells in the what's called the upper respiratory tract, the nose and the back of the throat. That's why you get a sore throat when you've got this infection. And it spreads rapidly because it's pretty infectious. And the thing that's really making people nervous about this particular virus is that you can be spitting out virus. I mean, not necessarily spitting it out, but having it come out of your mouth as you talk, or maybe as you sneeze or as you cough, without necessarily feeling sick. I mean, you could feel fine and all of a sudden, you know, you have one sneeze and you think, well, what the heck? That doesn't make any difference, one sneeze. But if you are infected already, even though you don't feel sick yet, you can be spraying virus out. And if somebody's in the neighborhood, or if you spray it on a doorknob, or you handle a doorknob after you sneeze into your hand, and somebody else grabs that doorknob and then touches his face or her face, there it gets spread. And I think the final question was it infecting people before the first person was infected in this outbreak? And the answer is, well, yes and no. The coronavirus is a class of viruses that look pretty much like what I described, that orange with cloves studded in it. This particular coronavirus doesn't seem to have been in humans before about December of last year. There's lots of other coronaviruses that are in humans. Many of them just cause the common cold and don't make us particularly sick. Some of them caused what was known as SARS, which was an outbreak in 2002, 2003. And then there was another one called MERS, which was in 2014, 10, something like that. Anyway, this is another version of that class of viruses. And it doesn't appear, people are not 100% certain where it came from, but they think it actually was in bats.
In bats.
And somehow, yeah. Bats. Yeah, bats. And somehow it got transmitted from a bat to a human. Now, I don't know if maybe someone had a pet bat, or there's some talk about bats in a marketplace, or maybe the bat infected something which infected a human. The exact steps that led it from the bat to the person are a little obscure.
That's still a mystery. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, we're talking with Joe Pelka. He is a science correspondent for NPR. And Joe, I think we need to take another kid here. And this is Jackson who's joining us with a question. Hi, Jackson.
Hi. So I have a question about the masks that you wear. Like, are they, should you wear masks in public? Does it, like, make a difference? Or, like, what's the difference between the N95s and the surgical masks? And do you think that, like, there's any way the virus could have been man-made?
Great questions, Jackson. Thanks.
Well, let's answer the second question first. There is some theory that says it could have been something that humans did, a modification of an existing virus. Most scientists discount that. Even if it turns out that it came from a laboratory, they think it was a strain that was collected in the wild and then might have escaped from that laboratory. But they don't think that someone in the laboratory tried to create it for the purposes of making the world sick. So it's probably not something that was made in a lab. Now, to the mask question. Well, the N95 and the surgical masks are very different things. The N95 is really designed to screen out very carefully anything small that you might breathe in. That could be dust, it could be asbestos, it could be a virus or a bacterium. The trick with an N95 mask is it's very important to put it on correctly, because what you want is no air leaking around the mask. All the air that you breathe is supposed to come through the N95. They actually call it a respirator, so that only clean or filtered air comes into your mouth. Now, surgical masks are a different beast altogether. They are usually just made out of some material, cotton or some other material that is intended to screen out some things, but mostly it's to keep big particles from flying into your mouth. I mean, to be gross about it, surgeons wear the mask so that if they're in surgery and somebody starts spurting blood, it doesn't get all over them and they don't wind up swallowing it. Yuck.
Mm, yeah, yuck.
So, yeah, yuck. I mean, that's what I said when I heard that. So the idea is that, yeah, they have a function, but they aren't intended to block viruses. They can't block viruses. They're not able to filter the air that carefully that a virus couldn't get through. So why wear them? Well, the answer is it will filter out some. So if somebody happens to sneeze at you, it's probably going to stop the bigger particles that are in the sneeze that are carrying the virus. But just as importantly, it keeps you from infecting others, because if you happen to have the virus, which I certainly hope you do not, I'm confident that you do not, and I'm certain, in fact, the good news at least is that most people do not. But if you do happen to be infected, it prevents you from spraying the virus out of your mouth and getting onto other people. So in a way, it's partly to protect you. Yes, but it's also to protect other people from you. And I don't mean to say that you're a bad person and that you have some virus and that you should be masked up. It's just a security thing for everybody in the society, since we don't know who is infected, to take care that any of us could be infecting somebody else.
Just a good safety measure. Jackson, thank you so much. Let's bring in John now in Zion, Illinois. Hi, John.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Listen, I've watched MythBusters. I don't know if you're familiar with the program, but
sure.
they did a test study on March 29th on how far sneezing and coughing can travel. And
yep.
they did this study inside their building on a white sheet of paper, and both of the guys, one guy squirted 16 feet by coughing and sneezing, the other guy went 17 feet.
Wow.
Coughing. Now, you can imagine you take that outdoors and you're in public and you sneeze or cough. That virus or whatever it might be can travel 30 feet, 60 feet.
It's quite a range. No. John, we're short on time here. Joe, what would your response be to the range of sneezes?
Well, I mean, exactly the point of wearing a mask. If you're wearing a mask and you sneeze, presumably the sneeze will only travel an inch or so or less because it hits the mask. The other thing is that as you sneeze over that distance, it's not like a laser beam. The sneeze spreads out. And so if you're saying, well, what if I walk through the path of somebody who's just sneezed? Well, yes, that's probably not good. But the number of viral particles throughout that pathway may be small as opposed to somebody who sneezes right in your face.
Well, we have to pause right there with NPR science correspondent Joe Palca, who's with us to explore the pandemic and the world of science with you at 800-642-1234. We'll be back with him right after this news update on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And a brief mention here that listener support, that is the largest source of funding for WPR programs you rely on each day. Give it this number in the last day of our spring member drive. The number is 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. And thank you so much for your support. Right now, we're talking with longtime NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. We're delving into some of the very fluid questions that have been coming in here around coronavirus pandemic, trying to solve problems with the disease as he talks with scientists around the world. So what do you want to ask Joe Palca about reporting on science? How do you think the news media is doing at covering COVID-19? Here's a good one. What science experiments are you trying out at home? Walk us through them. 800-642-1234. And Joe Palca stays with us for the hour. Let's go back to the phones now. Tim is joining us from Green Bay with a question. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
My question is about their testing for antibodies now, and I'm just wondering how they can correlate antibody with specifically the COVID and how they would know that antibody isn't related to some other infection.
Well, the answer is
Thanks, Tim. Yeah.
Yeah, Tim. Thanks. It's an interesting question. So the answer is that they take a bunch of viruses and they put each one in a little cell, and then they wash them with the serum or plasma of the person that they want to see if it has antibodies. And if they don't have antibodies, then the plasma just washes off and that doesn't stick to anything. And if they do have antibodies, then the antibody will stick to a part of the virus that's in one of these little cells or wells. And the reason it doesn't, you know, they don't react with other viruses is that they put a variety of viruses in this container or these different containers, and they test the blood or the serum against or plasma against each one of those. And only the ones that stick are the ones that you have antibodies to. So, you know, you could have antibodies to more than one virus, but you'll typically be able to tell whether you have antibodies to the coronavirus because that's the one that your antibodies will stick to when you are tested.
Well, so if it sticks, then we know that they're present. So let's look at vaccines here for a moment. And you've been looking into the effort to make a vaccine that will protect people from the coronavirus. First of all, what are vaccines and how do they fight viruses?
Well, vaccines actually it goes to this same question about how you detect whether somebody's been infected. So a vaccine is just a way of saying to the immune system, hey there, immune system, I'm going to show you a picture, not quite a picture, but I'm going to show you a picture of a virus. And when you see this the next time, I want you to respond aggressively and prevent the virus from gaining a foothold in your body. And that's how it's done, basically. Now, once upon a time, they used to take a whole virus or a parts, mostly a cut up virus, and they would either inactivate it, which means they would modify it in some way so that it couldn't copy itself, or they would take a fraction of it, you know, that actually physically was removed from a virus particle, and they'd put you into it. And on this, you know, if you want to continue the picture analogy, the virus, you know, if it goes in as whole, it looks like a virus, but there are certain parts that are most representative. So pay close attention to the nose in this picture, because the nose is what you want to be looking for. And the immune system learns to look for that particular nose. And when it sees it again, it revs up and attacks it.
Oh, so we're training the immune system in a way.
That's what we're doing. We're teaching the immune system how to respond. It's kind of interesting because the vaccine doesn't do anything to stop the virus from entering the body. The vaccine teaches the immune system to recognize the virus, and it's our immune systems that prevent the virus from entering our bodies. And it's really amazing that a lot of the drugs that we use, they don't actually do anything to the virus or the bacteria. They help our bodies respond. And that's basically what happens with vaccines. It's a way of telling the body, look, this is coming, it's out there someplace, and if you see it, if it comes into your body, you should recognize it for what it is, bad, and do something about it.
Well, let's bring in another call. Susan is with us from La Crosse this morning. Hi, Susan. What's your question?
Hi, thank you. My question is, COVID-19 is from bats, and SARS is from cats. What's the difference? How do you tell the difference? And my second one is, why should we be afraid of getting a virus from our pets in our house?
Well, okay, so the answer is that about how you know it's from bats, or I'm not sure that SARS is from cats or not. But the way you would tell that is you would take a sample of the bat's blood or plasma and look to see, you would try to isolate a virus from that and look at its genetic sequence and see how closely it resembles the genetic sequence of the virus that you're finding in people. So that's it's just a question of matching them up, basically. So you can sometimes, if you're lucky, find the animal that was first infected. In terms of pets, it's pretty unclear. There does seem, I mean, there were these tigers that got sick in the Bronx Zoo, and there is some report that cats can get infected. I don't know of any examples of how having the virus jump from the cat to the human. Hmm. In fact, the Bronx Zoo event seems to be the human infected the cat. One of the handlers of the animals got sick. So I don't think that pets represent a very large risk at this point.
Susan, thanks. Let's bring in Kay now in La Crosse. And Kay, I think you're on this same wavelength here with the question.
Yeah, that's right. I'm looking for some clarification on the animal to human transfer. The previous caller mentioned bats and was curious about that. I was wondering if bats as carriers are like all species of bats worldwide. And then the other thing is that early on there were reports that it seemed that this virus transferred through meat animals at live animal markets in China. So I'm curious about the animal-human transfer and the animals that can possibly carry this.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I wish I could say, oh, it's academically and we should study it. In fact, that is a case. It is an academic question and it needs to be studied. But I realize there's more like real-world concerns about how to cope with that question. The answer is, I don't think it's clear yet. I mean, it was in bats, in a particular strain of bats that was found in China. Whether it's in all bats or only some species of bats, hard to say. I don't think people have found it in bats around the world, so it's seems to be limited at this point to bats in China, but it's possible that more testing will reveal it elsewhere. In terms of going into other animals, I think, again, they talk about epidemiology as being a blunt tool, which means things could be happening that you might not be seeing. It is possible that a pet could be transmitting to a human. It may have happened. But to establish that is really difficult because you can't exactly say, sit in this room while I bring in infected animals and I'll see if any of them infect you. I mean, that's the best way to test it from a scientific standpoint, but it's not obviously an ethical thing to do. So you sort of have to wait until you see a pattern where, you know, people who have pets in their house are getting infected with the virus at a greater frequency than people who don't have pets in their house. And that's going to take a lot of time to identify. So I think it's not obvious that this is a simple, straightforward method of transmission. It seems like it happens rarely, but how rarely and how possible, the numbers are still needing to be worked out.
Lots of mystery there. We're talking with Joe Palka, science correspondent for NPR, taking your questions this hour about the coronavirus, about scientific research, and what you want to know. What is making you curious? Join in at 800-642-1234. Danny is now with us from Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Danny.
Hi, I'm actually a nurse in the Milwaukee, in downtown Milwaukee, and my question for the guest is, so from my observation, and just obviously this isn't a clinical trial or any sort of real study, but from our small perspective, there's a lot of talk in the news about ventilators, and, you know, ventilators are needed. However, what we're seeing is that patients aren't surviving the ventilators. And I'm just wondering if there's any broader perspective that your guest has, or if there's any talk about that, and that we maybe have the supplies, but maybe they're not working, and what's the plan for the future?
Danny, thanks.
Yeah, it's a great question, Danny. There is actually data to suggest that you're right, that many of the people who get to the point where they need a ventilator don't survive the experience of being on a ventilator. The problem is, you don't know which ones until you try. And if it's a 15% chance of surviving or a 30% chance of surviving, it's a little bit harsh to say, well, we put you on a ventilator, but 4 chances out of 5 or 3 chances out of 5, you won't survive, so we're not going to. A lot of people would say, no, I'd rather take my chances with a ventilator, even if it doesn't do the trick. The answer then is, well, maybe there are better drugs that will prevent the kind of damage to the lungs that makes people need a ventilator.
We got to pause right there with Joe Palka here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a quick mention here. You hear it often because it is so true that listener support is the largest source of funding for WPR. We've reduced this spring member drive. In fact, today is the last day. So your support right now for the programs you value is super important. Take a few minutes on this Friday and make your gift. Here's the number, 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. And thank you for your support. Right now, we're talking about science journalism and the tricky questions that scientists are working on with the coronavirus pandemic. We have NPR science correspondent Joe Palka at our side. He stays with us trying to answer these questions for us. And Joe, I know we are going to break there very quickly on ventilators. Anything you want to wrap up there as we look at that area of medicine right now?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was blah, blah, blabbing and made it hard for you to stop. But
that's okay.
No, it's just, I guess the point I was trying to make is that ventilators, once you get to ventilators, you're not in very healthy condition. And so the idea would be to try and find drugs that will prevent you from getting to that point. And hopefully those are being tested now and some of them will work.
You've been reporting on major drug manufacturers who are working together to find a solution here. What are you finding there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm impressed, I have to say, that at least the words that the big pharma companies are saying are very encouraging about how they're trying to pull together. Johnson & Johnson, for example, I talked with their chief scientific officer, and he says, look, we're gonna work on this, you know, on our own dime, because we realize we have a global responsibility. I guess so. I'm glad they feel that way. They're talking about making a factory. It's interesting. They're building a factory, or they're building factory capacity that can make a vaccine that they may never make. I mean, they may turn out that the one they're trying to build doesn't work. But they can't wait until they find out if it works to build the capacity to make vaccines to give to people, because if they wait that long, it's going to take another year from when the vaccine is shown to work. So they're trying to build the capacity now, and that's a gamble. GSK and Sanofi, another two big companies, are also saying we're going to build capacity and we're going to work together. It does feel like an all hands on deck kind of moment in human society, and I hope that's a good thing, and that people will keep that kind of spirit going until this is fixed.
Well, let's bring in Russell now in Beaver Dam with a question. Hi, Russell. Are you there? Doesn't look like Russell is with us. How about Jeff in Superior? Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. Beautiful sunny day up here in northern Wisconsin. So I appreciate this opportunity to discuss this. I have friends that go to Northland College in Ashland, and their parents have spoken with me about research they were doing in the University of Winnipeg in Manitoba, or University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And last year, or within the past couple of years, there was a Chinese scientist arrested because they were doing research on viruses, various strains of viruses, and how they adapt to different environmental conditions. And they were collaborating with Chinese scientists. And these people that I know in Winnipeg believe, among others, that there might be a connection, because this Chinese scientist was arrested with possession of these viruses he was taking back to China. We believe that one of the things they're investigating is, was this related to that incident last year? And I was wondering if the guest had heard anything about that.
So was there foul play involved? Joe, have you heard about this incident?
Not the Winnipeg incident in particular, but there are a lot of concerns about the trends in carrying biological materials around the globe. And it's always very difficult, because if you want to study a dangerous pathogen, well, you have to have it in order to study it. But if you have it, that means you could be doing something you ought not to be doing with it. So it requires a certain level of trust. I don't know in this particular case what the circumstances are, but it's certainly the case that they call this dual use. I mean, there's things that you can be studying for the most benign and friendly reasons possible, and there are ways of turning that same kind of research into something that would be bad. I mean, people think about this all the time. It's not always 100% clear how you prepare to prevent people from doing the wrong thing. But then, I mean, that's true of anything, really. I mean, as we say, guns are just guns, but if people take them up and shoot innocent people, they're not such good things. So, they have a potential danger. How you determine that, whether people are going to take advantage of that potential danger, that's a criminal development.
And accidents can happen. Unintended consequences can happen in a lab in the science world as well.
Absolutely.
Well, let's bring in Paula now in Dodge County with a question. Hi, Paula.
Good morning. My understanding is that in general, a fever is our immune system's way of fighting off disease. But But in this case, if it actually overreacts and makes things worse, should we be taking a fever reducer sooner so that to balance things out rather than letting it run its course?
Well, let me make the following caveat that I am not a medical doctor. So my what I'm going to say now is based on some science reading that I've done. I'm also, turns out that I do have a PhD, but it's in psychology, so it's not going to help.
This one's not going to help you out, right?
Right. So basically, here's the thing. The infection, you're right. The body raising its temperature is a way of fighting off the infection. But it's a little bit of cause and effect. If you push down the temperature, the fever, it doesn't mean that you're controlling the thing that's causing it. It just means that you're relieving the symptoms. And so your immune system may be having this reaction, and there's nothing you can do about it until the immune system decides that it's done having this reaction, except for taking a pill that will lower your fever. Now, is that good for you or bad for you? Well, presumably it makes you feel better. Whether or not it shortens the course of the disease or makes you makes it a better chance that it won't be as hazardous for you, I think is a little bit more of a complicated question. So, I mean, if just aspirin were all that were needed, or acetaminophen or some other antipyretic, it's called, drug, I'm sure they'd be giving that out like candy, because they're not very dangerous drugs. But obviously there's more to it than that.
Paula, thank you so much. And Joe, we have time for one more question. You've been reporting on COVID-19 for months now. And before this pandemic, you've reported on all kinds of science stories. We have a question for you from Bronwyn from Madison, who I know quite well. She wants to know, what's the hardest science question you have ever answered? And then what is that answer?
Every time somebody asks me that question, my mind goes to one of the most terrible stories I tried to explain, and I'm still not sure I can explain it, but it has to do with something called optical interferometry. And now that I've said that, I'm getting the shivers, because I have to try to explain what it is. I don't really get it, but basically the idea is that you can take two telescopes that are looking at waves out in the sky and merge them together. Now, when you merge them together, you get this funny pattern, which I don't quite get. But by interpreting that pattern, you can make a telescope appear to be as big as the two smaller telescopes you have separated. So it's like creating a virtual telescope that's 10 feet apart, even though each individual telescope might only be 1 foot in diameter.
Oh, wow. Well, we're going to leave it there.
You
we
got
have to
that?
Leave it. I got it. Let's leave it at telescopes. Joe, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Joe Palca, NPR science correspondent. Just ahead, it's On Point with its wrap up of the week in the news. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.